Welcome everyone, honorable members, and a special welcome to our friend from the National Treasury, the FSC. You're welcome. Honorable members, today we're dealing with the Division of Revenue. I must confess that Mr. Brown, I don't know whether it's my head, it's the side, my heart is still somewhere else. So, still having the challenges of approach, but in terms of the Money Bills Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act, this committee is supposed to deal amongst others with the Division of Revenue as the Committee of Appropriation, after which you would pass and then give to our colleagues in the National Council of Provinces. I must welcome my colleague from the NCOP, Chairperson Chane. We're together here. We have a challenge, I'll say, as Parliament, in terms of the timeline that that Act gives. But so much needs to be done by when. We do understand that we must pass the fiscal framework by the 2nd of March. In fact, on the 2nd of March. Division of Revenue on the 4th of March, after which then it will be submitted to NCOP. Now, the Act speaks about 35 days within which it must be passed by the NCOP. The rules have not yet been amended to be aligned to this Act, but clearly the Act does speak about the committees working together. I think that it will be important, even though the Act might not have been formally referred to NCOP, that we work together, because I think that we have had discussions between ourselves, in fact within Parliament. Zarina has, as an observer, attended those meetings, where Parliament thinks that the Act can be passed any time. We insist as the Appropriation Committee that this Act must be passed by the 31st of March, so that come the 1st of April, allocation then can begin to departments can start spending. There are issues of grants, which might be new, or it is a discussion that National Treasury will continue to be there. And I think that one day, I'm not sure this week on Thursday, we have a meeting of a task team we'll be having a meeting with the leadership of Parliament. But it's discussing only one portion of that Act. But generally, the issue of time frame is very key to that Act. It means that we need to clarify, for example, if we're talking about 35 days, and if you're talking 35 days, once National Assembly passes the Act, it means that it can only be passed in April. As I said, that we need to come up with the rules or regulations that will can guide us in terms of by when exactly would we want this the division of revenue to be passed. It's clear about other things, the fiscal framework, it's clear by when. But also, Mr. Brown and company, with the division of revenue, we see that the presentation is not very short. but we have noticed, I hope that the members have read the just perused the budget review report, because during the MTBBS, at the time of passing the MTBBS, we made recommendations. Now, there are responses of those recommendations that we made at that report of the MTBBS. They are contained in the budget review. National Treasurer has responded to those recommendations that directly affect them and referred others to the relevant departments. But also, there is information that with those that have been referred to the relevant departments, what has happened. There was a whole range of recommendations that we made. But amongst those recommendations that we made was the issue of conditional grants. We were seized during the medium-term budget policy statement discussion about an issue of conditional grants that were approved by National Treasury for co-opta. But also part of that approval was that those conditional grants may be redirected elsewhere. And as a committee, we're not comfortable with that, because we are quite aware, all of us sitting around this table, that the capacities of the municipalities are not the same. And therefore, we can't leave behind those municipalities that don't have capacity. We know that some of municipalities do not generate any revenue altogether. They entirely depend on this conditional grant. And therefore, you can't redirect them. National government, in terms of the Constitution, 3154, enjoins national government and the provincial government to support the local government, the municipalities. And unless that we are seen to be doing that, it's going to be difficult for the committees to accept anything else. In fact, I think that we'll have to engage generally on this stopping of funds. In fact, I like the Constitution. The Constitution, we have not really followed the Constitution to the letter, National Treasury, because the Constitution enjoins National Treasury in the situations where you really stop, you want to stop that, to engage with the National Council of Provinces. And the funds have been redirected without necessarily engaging the NSOP. In other words, NSOP must also approve of those what we call a redirection. It is the Constitution that says that. And I think that unless we do that, so. But I'm just taking one recommendation among the number of recommendations that we made. And I hope that one thing, maybe, Mr. Brown, when you do your presentation, that you might assist me with that I did not find here. In the other division of revenue, there used to be a clause that would allow the receiving department or entity to spend not more than 4% of that on capacity building, you know. I was trying to look for this subsection from this division of revenue. I could not find it. You will assist us during your presentation. So, but on that note, I would like to allow you to present to us. Over to you, Mr. Brown, and the team. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, and Honorable Tani as well there, and members of the committee. It is always a privilege for us to present to the committee and to give whatever information is needed for the committee to actually exercise its oversight responsibility. And I think that will continue to be the culture within the National Treasury to do that. Before I start, let me just introduce my colleagues here. We brought our lawyer, Janine, here to be able to assist us with whatever questions the committee may ask. No, she must look for that clause that's gone whilst I'm talking. And you've got Wendy. Wendy is the chief director that's responsible for intergovernmental relations. So every policy matter that relates to provinces and municipalities is actually handled by Wendy. Now we've.
There's something that I'm missing from Wendy. You and I, Wendy, you know what you. And, you mustn't come here to Parliament without that. I'm not going to mention it.
Okay, continue.
Yeah.
Obviously, you will ask questions about the Constitution, Chair. That's
why. We've prepared 79 slides. About 5 or 6 of them are actually just cover pages in between, but I will try and expedite the presentation, but without losing the essence, basically, of it. So how the presentation is structured, we're looking at the bill, and then we're looking at, in terms of the Money Bills, Amendment Procedures and Related Matters Act, the recommendations that the both committees have actually made in terms of the bill, and we will briefly just talk to that there. Then we will zoom into detail into the Division of Revenue Bill. What I've asked Wendy to include in the presentation is a clause-by-clause kind of narrative of it, but you can guide us whether we need to go through it or whether we need to just focus on what has changed there. Then we look at the fiscal framework itself, and in the fiscal framework we will look at the priorities of government and how that is aligned to a great extent to the money and the additional resources that has been given basically there. And then we then talk to the FFC's proposals and government's response to that as well, and we go into detail into provincial and local government allocations there. Now, on slide number 3, basically the bill originates from the Constitution and the Intergovernmental Fiscal Relations Act, because it requires that every year when the minister tables a budget, he must table this bill there. And this bill covers all of the issues that I've raised in my introductory remarks there. And what makes it different this year is the Money Bill Amendment Procedures and Related Matters Act, actually, on how we've treated the bill in the past. So slide number 4 says when the budget is tabled, and we know all of those things now, that I don't have to go basically through it. So we have included a report in the budget review, and we will try and give a synopsis of that specific report. The first one deals with the point that you've raised, Honorable Togoni, Chair, on how rollovers needs to be managed then. And what while government agrees that you know we need to manage these grant systems in such a way that it doesn't prejudice poor performing municipalities in a specific way, government is also a bit conscious of the fact that you also don't want a situation where you put money into areas where they are not being spent also, and while there are other areas within the country where that money could be utilized. So getting that balance right is important. But with that, we also need to look at the point that you're making, saying we need to build capacity. But I think we also can't build capacity forever in this country. We need to get to a point where we say the capacity that has been built is indeed sustainable and will result into a better delivery and better spending of the grants. But having said that, how the division of revenue bill is crafted, you've got withholding clauses, stopping clauses, for example, in here for that matter. But before you can even get to that, before we even give to a department the go-ahead to withhold and stop money, the first question that we ask is, what are you doing as the owner of the conditional grant to build the required capacity to deal with it? So we try and solve it already in the in-year kind of situation there. But what we also need to be conscious of, and I think what is nice here, Honorable Chair, is you restrict it to make. And I think we support that. For now, we will have to build that kind of capacity. And we are actually actively involved in building that relevant capacity to deal with that. On land and rural development, I think here the committee says this is central in development in the country, and it is crucial for rural development in that sense. And the committee says more money needs to actually go into supporting this. Now, if you look in the E&E and the chapter under rural development, for example, the Department of Vote is responsible for rural development and land reform. When the program of land reform started about a few years back, if one looked at 2006 and 7, what you had, government was spending close to about 900 million on both land reform and land restitution. What government will spend at the end of this financial year, government will be spending about 4 billion rand on land reform and another 2.5 billion rand roughly on restitution. And that money continues actually to grow. By the end of the MTF, we will be spending roughly about 4.7 billion rand on land reform alone. Now the question that's been asked is, there's an institutional problem that also needs to be resolved on the land reform side. The issue around willing buyer, willing seller, for example. Because you can add money to it. If some of the processes that inhibit actual transfer of the land are not resolved, the money may remain unspent, and we've seen it in past experiences that to be the case. But also, land reform and restitution is not only about transferring the land. The view is around what happens to the people who receive the specific land, that we need to have supplementary programs for that. And if you look at our agriculture spending, for example, in provinces, we're spending now on average about 8 billion rand annually on agriculture alone to support, for example, emerging farmers in a various number of programs. And I think what we acknowledge is the fact that our agriculture departments in provinces have to jack up their act as well to be able to make this happen. Money alone will not solve it there. But in addition to that, we've added another 860 million for land reform. But what government has realized was to say specifically to the rural setting, that rural development itself has got to do with access to water and sanitation as well for human consumption. Because there's that element that we have, I wouldn't say neglected, we've tried to fund it through the municipal infrastructure grant. But I think government is coming to the realization that that will not necessarily solve those specific problems then. So we've started now with a grant that will specifically look at the rural water and sanitation kind of problem, and there to look at specific issues that will take into account the different technologies that need to be put in place to support that thing. The next slide talks about asset management. I think we actually fully support the recommendation that you are making, not only in terms of DPW, for that matter, Department of Public Works, I think for the whole country, for that matter. The issue around asset management is a big problem. And we are looking at ways of ensuring that this needs to happen. But we are conscious of the fact that you say within 3 months, there must be a report coming your way in terms of how at least the Department of Public Works is managing this part. This has been referred to the Minister of Public Works, and we will engage him and come up with a report in that regard. On water infrastructure and the maintenance of it, the committee says the Department of Water Affairs must make adequate provision in its planning and budgeting to fund the maintenance of water infrastructure. And I think we need to pause and talk about this. Government needs to actually step back and say, how do we actually manage our entire water infrastructure systems there? Although this has been referred back to the Department of Water Affairs for them to formalize some kind of a response, the government is now also looking at ways of saying, how do we align our funding mechanisms as well to be able to address this problem? Because the question is directed to the Department of Water Affairs. But the Department of Water Affairs, when it comes to municipal water provision, for example, that is funded, for example, through the municipal infrastructure grant partly, and through its own water operating subsidy. So it will talk to its water operating subsidy and how that is managed, but how do we get it to be accountable for the municipal infrastructure grant part of it? And I think the streamlining of that needs to be resolved. But in addition to that, municipalities themselves have got a responsibility to maintain that specific infrastructure. And I think to get resources from the center alone to solve that problem, I don't think it would be a prudent public finance practice to be able to do it. So whilst national government will be able to provide support, municipalities themselves, out of their own resources, will have to come to the party and provide for this. Because a number of them, in any case, use the water infrastructure to generate revenue. So they need to find a way of taking part of that revenue and plowing it back there. Then, Wendy, we can move to the next one. On the issues around economic development and rural development, in addition to some of the points that I've made, the committee is saying that additional funds need to go to rural development and land reform. And I think I've covered quite a bit of this. But in addition to what we say here, about 1 billion rand is given to the new Department of Rural Development to accelerate their rural development programs there. Another point that the committees are making here is to say we need to deal with capacity building in rural areas as well. So we've got the CN Zamanja program, and we are engaging the DBSA in a way that says, how do we realign it so that we can actually make a lasting impact on the rural ones as well. Now, honorable chairs and members, once we start to analyze some of our municipalities, then you will come to the conclusion there's about 50 or 60 municipalities that even if you build the capacity there, the capacity will not last given the nature of the setup within those municipalities. So we need to explore possibly a different delivery kind of mechanism for those specific kind of municipalities, which we are looking into as well. There may be a smart way to use the districts, for example, to help us to roll out some of the things. It is an option, but it can create problems in itself if it's not properly managed there. Then on the economic crisis, the committee's recommendations are noted and agreed, and I think these have been referred to the Deputy President for that matter. So all of the points that we are making there is to say in the budget we already see certain measures that are in the budget itself to start to deal with that. If one looks at how we manage fiscal policy, for example, our public infrastructure investments, the 840-something billion that we talk about there, and if one considers about close to 150 billion of that will be spent in province and another 120 billion will be spent in municipalities. If it's wisely spent, it could provide a cushion for, or at least a platform for job creation within there. And then we use the G20 at a global level to be able to look at the mitigating circumstances as it relates to that. On the wage-based incentives mechanism, I think what the committee is saying, this needs to be extended to quite a number of sectors. Now here, and the minister has indicated in his speech, that this, in addition to the EPWP program that we have, what we're going to see is some kind of a policy framework that will come out by, I think the minister said, is the end of March, right, where a clear indication will be how this wage incentive system will actually be working. So I think I'll plead that we wait until such time that that is available, then we can respond quite clearly on what the committee is raising. The committee also raises the issue around efficiency and effectiveness of education spending. I mean, this matter, I don't think we disagree there, and I think the current outcomes approach that the president is taking, and where the president wants to enter into performance agreements with the respective ministers based on those specific outcomes, is the kind of step in the right direction that says not only for education but for all sectors we need to see performance. Yeah. But the point that the committee is raising around education, these ones are actually accepted. And as a treasury, when we've presented the provincial budget and expenditure reviews over a number of years, we've raised this matter as a matter of concern. If you've read the Star yesterday, there's quite an interesting supplement within the Star that really highlights the money that goes in, but the outputs and outcomes that come out are not commensurate basically to that. So it is a key kind of issue. On the national health insurance system, the committee says this needs to be accelerated, and I think government agrees with it. And the Minister of Health has established an advisory committee for this purpose. But what the minister highlighted in his speech was to say there's quite a number of steps. Once the work is ongoing, there's a number of steps that we also need to, in parallel to that, need to put in place to ensure that the public health system actually is improved in itself to be able to be absorbed within the broader NHI there. Because the concern is this will just lead to quite a bigger pressure on the private sector health providers if government doesn't sort out its own house there. So part of it would be the issue around managing the infrastructure for health facilities, for example, dealing with the issues around letting the current system function kind of well. But in addition to this, there's a broader issue on the financing of provinces that also will come into play, and how health itself would be financed. We don't talk quite a bit around it there, but it is work in progress, and clarity around this thing needs to come through the system within the next year and a half, for that matter. On proposed additions to health budgets, I mean, the committee recommends that additional increases in health budgets are appropriated for 2010 to improve the efficiency and quality of services in the public health sector. I mean, if one looks at the proposals that are made in this budget, they are relatively in line with what the committee is saying. If one looks at about 8 billion or so that goes to HIV and AIDS, for example, which is a large chunk there, there's money that goes in to improve the service conditions of some of the health professionals that were left out. It is that. But in addition to that, we are now taking active steps to improve management in health departments themselves as well, because if you only add money and you don't deal with the management failures that are in the system, that would in any case create quite a bit of a problem. Now, I'm tempted to ask this one, but I'm going to ask it at some point. The minister in his speech spoke about the financing of concurrent functions and whether there's alignment between what National wants to achieve and the money that National puts in, and what provinces does in that, is an issue that will at some point come up. The next slide deals with capacity building and support for municipalities. I think we have spoken about that. We've got the Sien Zamanja program. We've got our financial management grants that support also this. These are, we agree basically to that, and we are looking at ways to further strengthening capacity building in municipalities. We are engaging the DBSA on how we think we need to actually just reorganize Sien Zamanja to be able to get the lasting impact on that. I don't know, Honorable Chair, because the presentation is so long, that we spend a bit of time on this part, but I'll be guided by yourself on our responses to the different committees on what they presented, or do I continue?
Mr. Prana, I would like, I think that maybe we should go through the whole presentation, if it's acceptable, remember, so that when we come, then we can deal with it. I also realize that there are really some points of discussion, but let us deal with the whole presentation.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Wendy? No, just move quickly. Yes, I'll go to Tom. You take over soon. She's very anxious to take over. The bill, you will notice, we have engaged with the FFC on the bill. The FFC, in one of the recommendations, I'm not too sure whether it was last year, where they said the bill is too long and it sometimes takes too many things that they think is not relevant to the bill itself. We need to rationalize. We need to rationalize the bill itself. So we have started with that rationalization process. And in our interactions with the FFC a week and a half ago on this matter, we have actually agreed that the FFC must come up with some kind of a draft bill that we can possibly use as a starting point of developing the next bill. So we are moving in the direction of really rationalizing the bill itself. The bill is with 39 clauses. It's got Schedule 1 to 8, which divides the funds between the three spheres and within the spheres itself. There's the objectives of the bill that's included in that. And the attachments to the bill, there's about 14 attachments to it there. And I'll quickly go through them as we move along there. Now, once the bill is enacted, the only parts of the bill that become the act would be the clauses as well as Schedules 1 to 8. The frameworks and everything that relates to it basically falls away. Hence the need, once the bill becomes an act, that we gazette those specific frameworks 14 days thereafter. Now, we have made specific changes to the bill. There were certain provisions that were focusing on specific grants that we've taken out. For example, last year we've introduced the EPWP incentives grant. That grant, what we've done is we've taken out all of those clauses and we've built them basically into the conditional grant framework there. Then there were certain clauses that were no longer necessary. The Gauteng rapid rail link loan, if you can remember, Honorable Chair, Gauteng province was given a loan of 4.2 billion, and to regulate that, we've put it in here. So that's no longer relevant, so that comes out. If you can remember on the Marathon matter, where Marathon was incorporated into Gauteng, but it was done very late in the process. So the funding, even as we speak, still is with Northwest. So the intentions of the clauses there was to just regulate that relationship between the two provinces during this transition period there. So from 1 April 2010 moving forward, Marathon will be fully fledged part of Gauteng. And I hope Mutse will not follow and the other places will not follow, because it just creates havoc in the system. New clauses that we've introduced there. The one relates to deducting of unspent conditional allocations of previous years. This matter has been the practice for provinces and actually for municipalities for some time, and it was in the bill there. Now, there was confusion whether we can do it from the equitable share for local government. For provinces, you can't deduct it from the equitable share. The constitution prohibits you from doing it. Right? But for local government, the constitution doesn't really kind of prohibit you. So all that we're doing in the bill is just to clarify basically that part. The second amendment that we've made to this has got to do with how we manage our BRT, bus rapid transport kind of system, the IRT in Cape Town. What the municipalities indicated to us, they said these are long-term kind of capital projects, and in many cases they need to go and borrow for this, and you know they want certainty that those allocations will not be reduced, for example, so that they can go out and actually tender for an entire project for that. So all that we're doing here is to give them the certainty that those funds will not be reduced moving forward. Then the third one, the very important one actually, has got to do with the pledging of grants, of conditional grants to municipalities. If I don't know whether the Honourable Chair and committee is aware, the Department of Cooperative Governance undertook quite a detailed study on the Limpopo wastewater treatment system there, and the funding basically there. And out of that came quite a bit of a report that says, actually, in addition to the management failures that are in the system there, quite a bit of additional resources are needed to really deal with the problems of water and sanitation in the province. Then there was a flurry where people then realize they can use the municipal infrastructure grant to go to the DBSA and pledge the municipal infrastructure grant so that the DBSA can then extend loans basically to them using that as some kind of a pledge. Now, there's a risk if this thing is not managed properly. Let me just highlight you some of the risks. Firstly, Our biggest concern is it will suppress revenue effort, because people will now know I don't have to go and collect the rates and taxes and water, because I can use this money to get the loan and use it to repay the loan. So the revenue effort will be suppressed within the municipality. So that for us is a concern. In fact, when we looked at Lephalale, for example, I think at the time, in fact, the property rates income was close to 17 million, I speak under correction, very low. And I was indicating to the head of provincial treasury in Limpopo, as well as the HOD for cooperative governance and traditional affairs. I said, now, once you tell Lephalale that you can use your municipal infrastructure grant to pledge, they will not increase that 17 million to whatever it needs to be. And if you think about it, Lephalale itself has nearly doubled in size, right? You've got the big players there, Exxaro, and a big number of conglomerates that are there. So surely, if you look at the property rate base, it shouldn't be 17 million. So there is that risk if you don't manage it properly. Then secondly, MIG is not only about rolling out new infrastructure. It is about maintaining existing and doing, and by the way, not only for water, it's for roads and all other infrastructure. So if you commit this MIG to this one project, you run the risk that the other areas of your infrastructure within the municipality may actually be neglected, and you're going to have a problem. Thirdly, there's the issue that you also raise, the issue around maintenance. Because if you commit the MIG and you don't have a full maintenance strategy to be able to support whatever you roll out, you run the risk that in 3-4 years' time, you will not have money to maintain or even to extend services, because you'll be committed to this 5 or 10 year loan that you have. So these are the risks. So all that we say in the clause is to say, you can do it, but let's engage. You need to do it in consultation with the Treasury so that we can really look at the issues that you need to do to mitigate the risks that are associated with that. Then the last major change that we've made to the bill relates to the accreditation of municipalities. Now, Cabinet at its Lakhotla in January, as part of the outcomes to the Minister of Human Settlements, it's going to be that our top 27 municipalities must be accredited. And as I'm talking to the committee, the Department of Human Settlements is actually actively on its way of making sure that at least it starts to accredit the top six municipalities, your metros, for now. Now, all that this clause does, because the accreditation will not be a full shift of the function to the municipality, so the money will still have to flow from the National Department of Human Settlements to the province, and then from the province to the accredited kind of municipality. So what the clause will do is to manage that kind of flow, right? That's the first thing. Secondly, what the addition that we make is to create certainty in the allocation. If the city of Cape Town knows that it is accredited, it must know what its allocation is going to be over the next 3 years, for example. So that kind of certainty must be in place. Thirdly, there's the issue around how do you manage withholding, stopping, and reallocation itself. So that is just aligned to the general process of dealing with that. Those are the major kind of changes. Yeah. The next slide, I don't know, I'll ask Wendy to quickly go through it, but you can guide us whether we need to skip the following five slides, because they just go through the bill itself, but you can guide us, Jack. We can skip those. Okay. When you go to slide 26.
I see that all of us are sharing now. We can skip. No, it's fine. If the advice is that it must be skipped, we can skip that, but I'm worried that it might not be everyone who has read it. And then the assumption is that, no, I've read it, okay, skip. But the idea is that we take everyone along. I thought that we would just close over them, preferable, not just keep them for that's for good. Just close over them, so that.
Wendy will run through it.
Sure.
If you think I was fast, Wendy is fast.
Honourable Sir, do you want that too?
No, I just wanted to say, Chair, all these clauses, they tell you in each case what every clause is there for. Mm. So if you should be looking for something, you can actually find it in there quite easily in the document. So, you know, that's why I'm prepared to allow to skip.
And, we have resolved that. She will just, I hear that Mr. Brown was traveling on X5, and she will be on the scooter, then it's fine for me. But I just want to make sure that at least there's a remark.
Okay, this is generally the framework that we've had for all the bills in the past as well. Clause 1 just contains the definitions. Again, this is the standard definition. Clause 2 just deals that the division of revenue, it needs to be done in a cooperative spirit and how it needs to be consulted. Clause 3 and 4 and 5 are very important because they deal firstly with the division between the three spheres of government. And the second one, said okay, then deals with the division of the provincial equitable share. Clause 5 then deals with the municipal equitable share. And it includes in there to give certainty to municipalities exactly the date on which payments will be made. Something that's quite interesting here is just to note is that municipalities' financial year does not run into the same as national. What gets done is the funds are allocated in the national financial year. It's allocated to municipalities in terms of the payment schedule, in terms of the national financial year as well. So the last payment is done in March, and that thing will cover the municipal periods April, May, and June. And that we're moving towards a similar approach with regard to other conditional grants for municipalities as well. if you then look at clause 6, it deals with what you do if there's a money shortfall. If there's a money shortfall, it's captured by national. If there's money overruns, that can then be allocated through the adjustment process. And it's generally gone for unforeseen and unavoidable expenditure, as well as commitments that were made announced during the budget speech, which were not completely ready to spend the money. If you then look at clauses 7, 8, it deals with the conditional grants to provinces and to municipalities. If you then look at clauses 9 and 10, as well as 11, 12, it deals with the responsibilities of the receiving officer that receiving the grant, as well as what the national transferring and the provincial transferring officers must do in order to ensure that the money is indeed correctly spent. When they need to report and how they need to report is dealt with in clause 13. Clause 14 is a very important clause. Remember, Mr. Brown indicated that when the bill falls away and it becomes an act, some of the things then get gazetted. Clause 14 then deals with that specific provision. If you then look at clauses 15, it just states that the grant must be used for the purpose it's allocated and is subject to the conditions stipulated in the various frameworks, which is also very important. If you look at clauses 16 and 17 and 18, this is the clauses that the committee has also shown a great interest. It's what do you do when provinces and municipalities get conditional grants and they don't spend it appropriately and they don't have the capacity and the processes that follow. With regard to clause 19, it's very specific currently. It deals with Schedule 6 and Schedule 7 grants. A Schedule 6 grant is a grant that's for a specific purpose for a municipality. A Schedule 7 grant is when a national grant department receives the money, it spends the money on a municipal service on behalf of a municipality. This one specifically deals with the Department of Water Affairs operating transfer, where the schemes are not yet completely transferred, and to ensure that the money is placed where it should be placed. It happens that, for example, staff has not been transferred to the municipality, and that they really need to ensure that the money then gets retained by the Department of Water Affairs, which they need to pay the staff. So it just allows for the conversions both ways. Again, it's valid to submit a report and indicate that the money will actually be used for the best purpose. If you then look at the remainder of the clauses, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, and 25, deals just with issues with regard to the actual administration of the grant and the management of the grant. And then if you look at clauses, let's see, am I now? 25, this is specifically important, which related to disasters, which allows for, in cases where there's disaster, the money may be spent in the interim, but it will still be regulated through the adjustment budget process as well. And 26 and 27 are very important clauses. It deals with what departments that do have conditional grants, what they must do before the start of the next financial year to ensure that everyone is ready to actually spend the conditional grant. Therefore, a lot of things need to be done before the start of the financial year.
I'm very clear those clauses. And
then the last clauses, 28, 29, and 30, again, allocate responsibilities to municipalities and provincial treasuries and national treasuries. Just to stop at clause 28, because that is also quite important. There's quite a number of clauses there that's important. Kenneth touched on some of them. But there's also cases where the money goes to authorized municipalities for water and sanitation. When you get a situation where district municipalities authorize for water and sanitation, but mostly they just focus on the infrastructure delivery for the money that they get through the municipal infrastructure grant. But in a lot of cases, the local municipalities are still responsible for actually providing the service. And we need to start strengthening. It wasn't last year's act, but we need to strengthen that provision, because now some of the local municipalities actually run out of money because they need to provide to the poor, but the district is actually sitting with the equitable share money. So we're recognizing that, and the National Treasury is also strengthening its capacity to monitor whether that clause is actually complied with. And then the last few clauses deals again with transfers to public entities and municipalities, how you deal with unauthorized and irregular expenditure, and how you deal with financial misconduct, delegations and assignments, as well as exemptions from those provisions. And then the last one just allows for regulations, the repeal of the Division of Revenue Act, and then the short title. Okay, and then just to take you through the schedule, Schedule 1 contains the division of the between the three spheres. It's important to note here that if you look at provinces and local governments, it only contains the equitable share allocations. The conditional grants to provinces and the conditional grant to local government is actually contained in the national sphere, because that's not an entitlement. Schedule 2 contains the breakdown of the equitable share for provinces. Schedule 3 contains allocations per individual municipality. Just an important point to note here, there's also other clauses that support the equitable share, which provide, for example, in a case where a district municipality gets the equitable share for water and sanitation, what should have been the breakdown per local municipality. And that's to assist municipalities, the local municipalities and the district municipalities, to agree on the funding agreements between themselves. Schedule 4, this is a very important clause. It deals with Schedule 4 grants. It's important to note here, a Schedule 4 grant is very specific. It is different to a Schedule 5 and a Schedule 6 and a Schedule 7 and a Schedule 8 grant. The Schedule 4 is where government adds up or contributes to the money that's already been made available by provinces, for example, for infrastructure spending, and it's just to ensure that specific infrastructure programs are indeed rolled out. The same applies with the municipal infrastructure grants, particularly with where it relates to the metros and the bigger municipalities, because the MIC allocation is but a very small contribution, and what the metro put in with regard to infrastructure and the larger municipalities are actually the majority of the contribution. If you then look at Schedule 5, this is specific allocations to provinces. Just to give an example, that would be, for example, HIV and AIDS grants. It will be the National School Nutrition Program as well. If you then look at Schedule 5, it's Schedule 6, it's similar to Schedule 5, but it goes to municipalities. If I can think of a few examples there, it's the financial management grants that's to build the support for municipalities to build capacity to do the financial reforms. Schedule 7 I've already touched on, and then Schedule 8 is the new grant that was introduced last year to assist provinces and municipalities to expedite employment creation through the EPWP programs. Last year it was just for infrastructure. This year it's been going to, and ultimately we're going to be extended to other sectors as well. It's not completely the social grant, it's not completely intensive grant as yet, but it's the intention to work out that program from 2011 to become an incentive grant as well. Okay. Yeah. And then the next clauses and annexures. This is the first one is Annexure W1. That's a legal requirement, as Mr. Brown pointed out. The first one is where we indicate how we took into account the constitutional requirements. Section 214 says we've got quite a number of requirements and put down, and we indicate to what extent and how we've taken it into account. Part 3 deals with how government has taken into account the FFC recommendations. I think an important point we need to make here is that it is not National Treasury's response to the FFC recommendations. What we do as National Treasury, we coordinate the input, but we consult it with all national departments as well as provinces. We get their feedback, we discuss it with the departments concerned, and in the end, it's national government's response. Parts 4 and 5 is extremely important as well because it provides more details than what's contained in the framework. It provides a detailed explanation of how the provincial equitable share formula is working. It also provides a detailed explanation on how the local government equitable share formula is working. It provides a detailed explanation, for example, as well as how the municipal infrastructure grant formula works. So it contains that type of detail. And part 6 is more for noting on the work that's currently ongoing that can have an impact on future budgets as we go forward. And then if you look at Annexure W2 for Annexure W14, it contains by detail all the conditional grants for all the conditional grants to local government per municipality. Just to indicate that we've included a new appendix. Appendix W14 wasn't there last year. It then indicates the threshold targets for both provinces and municipalities to qualify for the EPWP program, which is very important. And, Kira, should I continue? Or should we stop? Okay. Very important. Again, budget review, what is specifically important when it comes to provinces and local governments, not that the other chapters are not important. It's chapters 8 and chapters 9. Chapters 8 provides a bit more detail, for example, for health, for education, for municipalities and the built environment as well, and links it a bit back to the outcome. Chapter 9 then provides a detailed breakdown of the allocations, including the additional allocations that go to provinces and municipalities. And those are just again, and then it's the W2 and W2 again provides all the detailed information. But then it just, these slides just indicate exactly what the appendix deal with what conditional grant.
Thanks, Wendy. Honourable Chair, I don't think Wendy answered your question on that 4% capacity you were talking about. You're still waiting. Now, if you
in fact, you went so far across, never
mentioned. Yeah, but let me assist on that one. If you turn to page, what we've done, we've strengthened specific conditional grants to be able to give the kind of support, because that was related to the implementation of specific conditional grants. Then we also looked at certain programs of capacity building that are currently underway. Right? If one thinks of, for example, of the infrastructure development improvement program, either in provinces, right? So we looked at, there is a program in any case underway. We look at Senza Manja, for example, which also relates to the implementation of infrastructure at a local level. So we looked at that and then said we need to possibly just rethink some of these things. But what we've done, if you turn to page 118, for example, of the bill, and you look at the National Treasury, the infrastructure grant to provinces, for example, there's at the bottom of that page, there's an entire matter that deals with the issue around capacity building. For example, right at the bottom, right? And part of the capacity building is giving a bit of flexibility for treasuries to be able to provide money out of the infrastructure grant to provinces to deal with the issues around capacity. If you go to page 116, for example, where we talk about the human settlement grant, under the conditions, I think it's the fourth bullet, provinces may, that part. They talk about the 5% that the province can use to be able to deal with the management of the capacity of that specific program up to a specific ceiling, for example. In this case, the ceiling was set at 159. So given that we didn't want to generalize too much within the bill itself to give a carte blanche 4 or 5% for all specific kind of grants, but we're targeting the specific conditional grants that would need the kind of support to deal with capacity. I hope I've addressed your question there. Thanks. Thank you. Now, I think before we actually get to the fiscal framework, I think what is going to be important is just to recap what the priorities are. I think we all know where we come from, but the focus now is to actually move more towards outcomes way of delivering services there. So the five key priorities were articulated in the medium-term strategic framework. They were converted basically into 12 measurable kind of outcomes that covers mainly our main sectors, like, for example, improved education, improved health, for example, dealing with the criminal justice system, addressing the rigidities within the built environment, and improving human settlement, supporting rural development. So those were the 12 kind of things. But they are underpinned mainly by the ones that we've raised at the bottom there. So what we then have on the funding side, maybe to make life a bit easy, I don't know whether, but let me rather run through it very quickly, because I thought I can take you to this specific slide, because this slide in some way summarizes in numbers how the priorities are actually addressed, basically there, which is slide, I think it will be slide number 37, there, where it starts to show where the additional resources are actually going. In education, what we're seeing there is an addition of close to 14 billion for different kind of interventions there. What you see is a specific adjustment to the provincial equitable share, which deals specifically with mainly salary kind of adjustments. Then we see the additions that are made basically to health, and what is set aside to deal with crime prevention, justice there. And on the rural development side, and I think the question that you've raised, that money goes there, I think I've touched on that. The rural development portion that will be given to the Ministry of Rural Development and Land Affairs of about 860 million to start off the specific kind of department and to start to accelerate specific programs that relates to that. In addition to that, the land bank is further being recapitalized there. On the job creation and infrastructure side, what we have there is those respective kind of interventions that we see that will actually address those specific kind of priorities. And on the human settlement and local development side, there what we see is a further about 8.9 billion that really goes to that particular kind of sector. Then on the other adjustments, if we break it down, part of that would cover, for example, the establishment of the new department and a number of smaller kind of matters. But this gives an indication of the relative priorities, basically. There. So if we take all of those basically into account, and we add the savings of about 25.6 billion, we get to the 112 basically billion. Now what this slide says is we take last year's baselines and then we add new money. Of that addition, 6.6, 9.7 and 16.9 goes to national, 13, 14.6 and 17.8 goes to provinces, and that is the share that actually goes basically to local government. So if you add this up, it will come to 80 something kind of million. But in addition to that, national government has, through rescheduling of certain projects, through savings, have come up with another 25.6 billion that was reallocated to all of the priorities that I've shown in the previous kind of table of that. Something that was raised this year relates to how do we force provinces to save. At least now, you know, Honorable Chair, even before the economic crisis, I was traveling economy class and staying in the cheapest hotels. But what is very interesting now is I see all of the DJs are now joining me in economy class. You see, so it shows that they are now starting to save, to save a bit of money. I hope the FFC will join us soon in economy class as well. What the division about this shows here is basically the new baselines after we've added the new money now, basically to that. So government will be increasing its spending from non-interest spending from 691 in 2019 to about 836, basically there. And this shows the percentage shares, basically there. The next slide will show how, after these additions, what the growth rates look like. And we will notice that at a national level, the growth rates are far lower than in the other two spheres, basically, of government. So 9.3 for provinces, the growth, 16.5 basically for local, and what's growing fast is the local government equitable share. What we've included in the local government equitable share is NERSA tomorrow will be announcing the electricity increase. What is included in the local government equitable share is the part that will cushion the poor who are getting free basic services, free basic electricity there. So it will not impact on those specific municipalities through that. There. Now, what you then have here on slide 42 is what is Schedule 1 in the Division of Revenue Bill. This is how the money is then split between the three spheres. You can move, Wendy. Right. And Wendy will get to the FFC's responses.
Okay, I'll take you quickly through the FFC responses. They had 8 chapters in their recommendations to the 2010 budget, which we've considered. I already indicated the process which we went through to actually consider it. The first recommendation, these are the breakdown of the 8 chapters that got. If you then look at the first chapter, deals with the review of the provincial equitable share. Quite an extensive report was submitted by the FFC, which dealt with principles, short-term solutions, as well as medium to long-term solutions. Government responses that we've agreed to a comprehensive review in 2007, which is currently ongoing, and we're targeting 2011 to have it implemented. The FFC makes part of this review, so as provincial treasuries as well. With regard to the public infrastructure investment, the FFC proposes and indicates the sector in which infrastructure investment should be prioritized. A second recommendation made is that we ensure that infrastructure development also supports employment creation and poverty reduction. And thirdly, a very important thing, also close to the heart of the committee, is that infrastructure maintenance strategy also be developed. Firstly, government full-heartedly agrees that infrastructure development should be prioritized. Substantial additions have been made available through the budget process that supports both provincial infrastructure as well as municipal infrastructure. Kenneth took you through the breakdown of the additional money. Secondly, there's also support given both within Jamanje as well as the provincial IDA program to assist provinces and municipalities to what we refer to as comprehensive infrastructure management, which also includes, as part of that, infrastructure maintenance. The government is doing the necessary to build that type of infrastructure and infrastructure management. If you then look at social grants, again, the FFC made 3 recommendations. The first one is to ensure that social grants are rolled out to poor people to protect them from the economic downturn. The second one is that should however not crowd out other types of expenditure, and the third one is again the link to EPWP. Government agrees to that, and if you look at also the expenditure, we've enabled the correct balance between social support but also other priorities. Again, the budget has got a strong link with EPWP. With regard to the fourth chapter, deals with the performance of public hospitals. Again, a number of recommendations are made here. But a link is also made with regard to norms and standards. And again, government agrees that the whole system be reviewed and that we should move towards a better system. Kenneth has taken you through that in quite a lot of detail, so I won't take you through that again. And then again, the chapter 5 deals with rental housing. Quite a number of recommendations were made here on extending the program, relaxing some of the conditions, etc. In terms of feedback that we received from the Department of Human Settlements, is the rental program is but a program within the bigger housing, social housing program, and it's very specific and targets very specific needs. And the chapter 6 then deals with the management and financing of road infrastructure. Quite a number of proposals are made here as well. The first one is that maintenance of roads are very important. Secondly, that greater coordination and road management functions are required between the three spheres of government. And then a proposal for the introduction of a separate conditional grant. What the response is, government is currently reviewing the provincial equitable share. As part of that review would be looked at as economic infrastructure, which will include the roads function. We again agree that there should be better coordination on intergovernmental level, and that that is also underway. The only proposal here that's important is that it's going to be very difficult in the beginning phases to consult with all 283 municipalities, and most probably the best places for entry would be the bigger municipalities in Saga to get coordination on municipal level rather than all 283 municipalities. And again, we refer to Sinjimanje and other programs that supports municipalities and provinces and infrastructure, including roads. Then Chapter 7 makes a number of proposals on universal access of water and sanitation. The first one has got to do with free basic water and sanitation. It links with the challenges currently in the way that the tariffs are set. Government agrees with that. It also agrees that there could be quite a lot of benefit to have stronger regulation of the water tariffs. The Department of Water Affairs are looking at that issue. Then with regard to the sanitation policy, that sanitation policy should not just focus on infrastructure, it should also have a very strong focus on sanitation practices and education of people to do the right thing. The issue is not so much with the sanitation policy, because the sanitation policy does acknowledge both components. It's more an issue of what municipalities are doing. Municipalities, in terms of their budgeting and practices, focuses more on the infrastructure side. So most probably it's more to do with capacity building than changing the policy. And then the last one is the regulator. It is something that government is looking at, we'll look at the best way of taking this proposal forward, the regulator. And then the last one is municipal capacity support. The issue is, again, a number of recommendations are made. Just one issue that we need to mention is the issue about the Sinjimanje program, and that it should be included in the Division of Revenue program. It's very important that we understand how Sinjimanje works, and agree that we should make this process also more transparent and look at how we deal with that. But Sinjamanya program, and together with DBSA, this is where national government actually looks at how it supports municipalities in its capacity rollout, similar to what provinces do. They also focus on building capacity. So we do not know upfront which municipalities will experience financial difficulties, and therefore it does not need to be regularized through the division of revenue, because it's not a transfer to municipality. No money gets transferred. It's actually providing support to municipalities to build their capacity. But what we need to look at, and it's also one of the things that's included in the monitoring proposal by the presidency, is to establish a staff team to actually look at ensuring that there's more integration in the support that's given to municipalities, so that we move away from this, you know, lopsided way of giving support to municipalities, and also having them more predictability and more agreement on the allocations that go, or the support, not allocations, that go to individual municipalities.
Thanks. Then on the provincial allocations, I mean, we took all of those additional money, we then put it on provinces' equitable share as well as the conditional grant. And I'll just run through the changes in the equitable share as well as the changes in the conditional grant for provinces. Yeah. So the equitable share is divided through an equitable share formula. All right. Now for the 2010 budget, we've retained the formula. But I think I need to mention to the committee that we are currently reviewing the equitable share. If the Honorable Chair can remember, a number of questions were asked last year, and we've indicated that we are reviewing the formula. We hope that by the end of July, we'll be able to present something to Cabinet, and where we can actually find a way of introducing the formula moving forward, basically there. For this budget, we're retaining the structure, and we only update it for available resources. The part of it is we take the latest available media estimate of population, the 2007 community survey, the 2009 enrollment data, 2008 general household survey data, 2007 GDPR data, and the income and expenditure survey for 2005. We update the formula basically with all of that. In addition to that, we've realigned all of the data sets so that they take into account the fact that Merafong has shifted from Northwest into Gauteng. And once we've updated the formula, we have then phased it in there. So in updating the formula, these are the shares then that it generates. On your right-hand side, the far end, basically what the Eastern Cape should be getting is 15.2% of the equitable share for the next MTEF, and so the other provinces 6%, 17%, and it goes down to 9.2%. But these, if you go to the next slide, are markedly different from the weighted shares for 2009 and 10. So if you were to move from 15.6 immediately into 15.2, we would have had to decrease the equitable share for Eastern Cape, for example. Now, to mitigate the impact of it, we're phasing it down so that the Eastern Cape can adjust basically its expenditure in line with what will happen. What will happen in the Western Cape, for example, their share will increase from 9% to 9.2%, for example. You see in Northwest it decreases from 7% to 6.7%, and then go up again. That's because of that Merafong adjustment that's taking place. Then you see the jump basically in Gauteng from 16.9 to 17.3, getting to 17.7 is because they've also received part of it. So once we've updated the entire formula, it generates the previous table, and then this table just shows how it is phased in over the next 3 years. Then this table will then basically show what the actual equitable shares are for the provinces. I don't think the heading should be full impact. It should just be the equitable shares, the new equitable shares for the provinces. Now, if we go to the next line, what it then says, basically, it takes the 2010 and 11 equitable share, and it says, what does this province also get in terms of conditional grants? Then it adds it up and say, for the 2010 and 11 financial year, these provinces, this is the transfer that they will get for 2010 and 11. Then the next slide says there's a number of conditional grants that are in the system. There's new ones that are actually added. The bottom two, I think, were there. They were announced in, not the bottom two, I think the second and third, and the technical secondary schools and the Denali Lady Schools one, was basically introduced, but allocations were just made in the outer years, and this is just getting that part going. Then in the social sector, part of the EPWP program was to actually also but deal with the caregivers in the home and community-based care kind of sectors. But the fourth one is a very important one. If the committee can remember, further education and training colleges, they are currently being administered by provinces. Now, with the establishment of the Ministry of Higher Education and the Department of Higher Education and Training, there's a sense that this function actually needs to be located with the rest of the higher education and training kind of family, your universities and all of how you manage that part, basically. So the logic is to actually then shove that function there, so that one can also get better alignment at the national level with your CETA and also with the Department of Labor on how it wants to deal with the issues around employment and capacity building. So the function is then not shifting per se. It will still be administered by provinces, right? Because I think you need a constitutional amendment for the function to shift. Right? Now, so what will happen is it will be administered as a conditional grant while the legal process is actually unfolding there. For the benefit of the committee, how we have removed the money from the provinces. We went into each province's budget and looked at what they have budgeted for FET colleges. Right? Then we've aggregated that amount, and I think it comes to 3.1, 3.3, 3.4, somewhere, billion. Then once we've got that, you can't actually go and say, Western Cape, you've been spending 500 million, I'm taking 500 million out. You see, because you need to strip the equitable share bottom line by that amount. Whatever remains gets then divided by the equitable share for that matter. But then what we've done, we've used what the provinces currently are budgeting for FET colleges. We've used that as the baseline for the specific grant. Then the next slide basically goes into the conditional grants. The next two slides. It just summarizes all of the conditional grants that are in the system. Then this one we've included. The minister has raised this thing in his speech, and we thought maybe the committee must also mull with it. Specifically mull over it with when you start to ask the question around the Money Bills Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act. Because I think it is within the powers of the committee to say, add monies, for example, into education in this. But if the committee says it at a national level, for example, and it gets passed, does it materialize at the provincial level? How do you deal with it? Basically that. Right? So there is, how do you deal with that specific dysfunction? In addition to that, you pass a bill that has got specific intentions. But do we see those intentions being reflected at the provincial level? I've put in here in the slide just some of the issues that we are grappling with there. For example, in Mpumalanga in 2008, 1% was deducted from the entire Mpumalanga department baselines to fund specific flagship programs like your core, Orlich route, the Maloto corridor, and a number of other issues. But what suffers there will be education, health, and, for example, social development. All right? And they've continued with that cut over the 2009 MTF as well. So you continue to get this misalignment. In Limpopo, as we speak, the province wants to redirect funds to a growth fund, for example. The province also wants to allocate money towards hand sanitation. We're asking, is that a specific kind of function? And given the pressure that we see in education and health, and given the priorities of government, basically that. In Northwest, you've got a similar problem there. But what's funny is the money goes to the provincial legislature. I don't know, maybe the legislature says, if you don't give us the money, we don't pass your budget. But the point is, there are a number of transfers that are made to specific... of the legislature, for example. You see. Right? Yeah. Then certain transfers continue to be made, for example, to public entities. Additions are made to that. And we all know about the growth funds, for example. So the question that one asks, you know, in the financing of this kind of concurrent functions, you see, do we get this kind of alignment actually right? And whether legislatures, in any case, can solve this problem actually at a provincial level themselves, because given the powers that they have to then solve this specific kind of problem. I'll ask Wendy to run through the last few slides. We nearly at the end of our presentation, Chair.
Thank you. If you then go to the next slide, it indicates the revisions to local government baselines. If you look at the top one, it's a technical adjustment just to explain why this money has been taken off the public transport infrastructure and systems grant. The grant or the policy developed was much more aligned to large metropolitan urban type of solutions. And when the program started rolling out, it was determined that it's not that appropriate in middle-sized municipalities. So what is being done is that the policy is currently under review to actually more applicable to smaller, medium-sized municipalities. As soon as that is sorted out, the money that's currently taken out will be put back again. There's been no downward revisions for the metropolitan municipalities at all on the allocation. Then with regard the equitable share, the money's already been explained. It's mainly to cover the electricity price increase, but also to provide for some relief for extending it to the poor households that's currently still outside the system. And then there's quite a number of increases made also to infrastructure grants, as well as money to indirect transfers. That's where the National Department spends the money on behalf of the municipalities. It's important to... the municipal infrastructure grants, if you look at the after year, $2.5 billion is added to this.
These are the additions.
Yes, additions.
Wow.
Yeah. This is the money that the top one indicates technical revisions. The rest are all additions. So if you look at the total additions to local government, it's $12.2 billion over the MTF.
Thank you.
If you then look at the next slide, this is a consolidation then of the money that was in the system. Together with additional money, this then indicates the total amount of money that's going to local government in terms of transfers. It also lists the general fuel levy that specifically goes to metros and with the replacement of RSC levy. So if you look at direct transfers, it increases from $50.1 billion in 2019 up to $73.2 billion in 2012-13. If you then look at the indirect transfers, that also increases from $3 billion to $4.6 billion in the upper year of the MTF. If you look at all transfers to local government, you look at the bottom line, it then increases from $53.2 billion up to $77.8 billion. And I think the next slide is actually much more important. A very important slide is what we've done is we've just tracked the local government equitable share since its inception. If you look at the starting years, it amounted to about 2 billion rand. If you look at 2012-13, it says up to about 34 billion as indicated on the slide. So it indicates the graph over a number of years. they could basically see from around 2003 or 2004, there's been a steady increase in the equitable share allocations to local government, and that's in a direct acknowledgement of the important role that municipalities play in service delivery to the poor. Okay, what's happening with the conditional grants? Two conditional grants are lapsing from 2010-11. We've been informed that these grants have actually performed quite well and has done quite a lot to actually extend water and sanitation and electricity to both schools and clinics. A new grant has been introduced. Kenneth has already taken you through that. It's an indirect transfer. It means it will go to the National Department of Human Settlements, where they will specifically explore alternative solutions where provisional or traditional conventional connector services are not viable or practical. Very important as well, cities to play a greater role in reducing housing and service delivery. It's not just the accreditation issue, it's also the MEG cities, which looks at infrastructure financing differently from MEG others, where there's a much more narrow focus on project rollout rather than long-term infrastructure budget planning. And then this slide is just a consolidation of all the total transfers that are going for infrastructure, which is 19.7 billion in 2019, which goes up to 29.4 billion in 2012-13. The next slide just contains the capacity building plans. These allocations are much more stagnant than the infrastructure grants. And these are just some of the future work that we're undertaking. Both the provincial equitable share and the local government equitable share formulas will be reviewed. There's also work ongoing in the Municipal Fiscal Powers and Functions Act that's been introduced to recognise municipal own revenues. And then there's also a bit of a section that just refers to the work ongoing to listening to the presidency to start introducing the monitoring and outcomes-based approach with regard to provinces and local governments.
Thank you, Honourable Chair.
Thank you very much. It was a very short presentation. From 10, now it's almost 2 hour presentation. But thank you very much, Mr. Brown and the team. I see colleagues are ready to engage. Honorable Swart.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. It's very clear. It would have been a much shorter presentation if you didn't have to go through all the clauses, but in any case, we now know what they're all about. But just two questions, Chair. The one is, you know, the district municipalities are getting equitable shares at the moment, and I presume mainly because they control DMA areas, district management areas, because they don't deal with the public directly, don't they? And once the new demarcation comes into being, you know, you're going to have wall-to-wall municipalities. There's going to be no specific areas which a district municipality is going to look at. Would that equitable share still go to the district municipalities? Then whether Mr. Brown can maybe indicate to us when the 27 municipalities that are supposed to be accredited or that will be accredited, you know, when those municipalities will be known apart from the metros.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to a little bit of explanation on this this new grant for local for municipalities. There is a innovative infrastructure that is talking about that if the conventional way is no longer viable. Just to understand what is it is quite a loaded language, so that I understand a little bit more about it. That first question, and I'll leave it there.
Thank you, Chairperson. With this new clause, it was such a long, the first bullet you explained, but I didn't understand, I didn't follow the explanation. Slide number 20. Aligning the disaccreditation, you explained there is a long explanation. Accreditation of any municipality, 21-6, and I, the more you explained, I lost the crux of this new clause. And I wish this clause number, slide number 75, lapsing a new conditional grant to LGs and other reforms. Two grants lapsed from 2010 and stroke 11, backlogs in water and sanitation at clinics and school grants, backlogs in electrification of clinics and school grants. So I don't understand why, what is going to, can I say, what has been achieved here? Because when we look at the schools and the clinics, the lack of water and sanitation and electricity, and the lapse of these two grants, I don't understand why they should lapse. I'll ask the other one. And I can only add this FFC recommendation, chapter 6, the one that has to do with roads. When are we going to come to that, for that alignment, that we see the repair of roads by SANRAL or by the provinces, not getting potholes in one province and beautiful roads in another province and a lot of potholes in the municipality? What is being done about the recommendations of the FFC? Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you, Chair. Only two questions. The one is about the land reform, the 860 million of the baseline. Is that going for new projects or existing projects where there wasn't enough money last year? And then the next question is about the capacity of local governments. That financial management grant, is that for training, for capacity building? Because I think that's identified by not only by SAGA but also by the committee last year. Thank you.
Thanks, and thanks for the marathon of the presentation. You spoke about the extended public works program. It's really a yo-yo. From your side as treasurer, do you see the impact of the expanded public works program with regard to certain skills development and actually its value for money for the country? The second question is on budgetary decisions and their implications. I don't know whether here we've got a problem or whatever, but at most times when departments are called by appropriations, they come and report that we made arrangements with treasury. Maybe in future, if departments come to represent from you as well, Chair and Treasury, could we have somebody representing that specific department? Because we seem to have this experience right through when presentations are being made, including Public Works, Department of Public Works, and the Department of Culture. Thank you, Chair.
Okay.
Thanks, Chair. I just want to check what would be the role of provincial treasury department
on this provincial budgetary decision and its implication insofar as it relates to provinces having to be at least in line with what we are trying to do at national level. And in terms of recommendations of the FFC and your response, chapter 2 in particular, I do not think that you are, there are some recommendations on social housing producer authority and intersectoral coordination. Your answer to that recommendation is the same like the one you provided for qualifying inhabitants, which to me, rather is not responding to the recommendation relating to qualifying inhabitants. If you check your responses there, they are both the same for two, for similar recommendations. I'm not sure that whether that is just a mistake or. But if you deliver it, then it's not responding to that particular question, and I would like to hear your views on that. Again, on the FFC, there's a recommendation with regard to implementation of a good, say, comprehensive, infrastructure maintenance strategy. I don't seem to see what is your response to that direct recommendation. Not unless, of course, I don't understand some of it. So if you could also reflect on that. And lastly, what would be the views of Treasury in the suggestion that in this country, because we are a water-scarce country, there's a need to build more dams? As you're talking infrastructure development, I've never heard of a need for building more dams in the country to preserve more water development. What are your views on that? I know it was once raised by one of the former ministers of government in the when President Mandela was still the president of the country, but he just died a natural death. And lastly, Chair, I did not get you, Mr. Brown, when you were, you just touched it, but you never get into the details of what is it that you are doing to assist or to make sure that provinces do save money, like you are doing at national level. Thank
you. Thank you, Chair. For me, I hear you saying there are 56 municipalities that you're saying, not in so many words, they are incorrigible in terms of being assisted. Now, you're not saying that maybe we should throw those municipalities into the deep waters and walk away from them. Is that what we're saying? What we are saying to these municipalities, look, we recognize that we're not the same. And therefore, it's not clear. I really didn't get you, Mr. Brown, what you were saying, but what is it that can be done to improve the capacity of those municipalities? Because we're not going to walk away from them because they are weak or what. Mr. Brown, for me, I think for us as public representatives, if Municipality A is not spending, because there are warm bodies there inside the offices who are not spending the money. But there are communities there in those municipalities that need those services. Take your Balfour, for instance. What do you do if Balfour is not performing? You close shop. But the communities need the services there. Not necessarily the, what they call it, the official. What is the approach? I mean, for me, I know that if you're, what you call it, but in this question, directing to yourselves in the absence of COPTA, but between us, natural and COPTA, it needs to be resolved. Because the communities need the services. The people inside the offices do not perform. Now we penalize the community because these people inside offices, they get bonuses, they get everything for not performing. Now, so I'm saying, so it's an issue that we need to maybe to deal with. You raised the question of the issue of alignment of priorities. The Constitution says we're a unitary state. So my understanding is that if the President says, this is what we're going to do this year. So, and I think that that's what the Minister of Monitoring and Evaluation is also trying to do, to say, how do we ensure that those priorities that are set out by the President cascade down to the smallest municipality? You don't have someone else coming up with your provincial and local government priorities. At the end, these priorities are distorted. Now you no longer know. I think that maybe that is the issue, but I think I agree with you that alignment is necessary, but the question is, what do we do about them? How soon do we move to ensure that there is clear understanding? I mean, everybody, when the President speaks, we heard that so many million people were listening to the President with expectations. Now the next day, or the Premier, or the Mayor will speak and come up with their own article. How do we deal with something that we need to find out? How do we deal with those structures? The other challenge that we have, I think that is raised by my colleague Mamuno, the public works. I think as the committee, the NCOP, we did raise when the issue of the incentive was raised for public works. I'm not sure, since it was introduced, if there has been any evaluation. Has it delivered? If not, what are the challenges? Because from this side of the table, we'll tell you that there are challenges. We all know that there are challenges. And in this time of where the money is so scarce, you want to expend every cent of efficiency. Now, public works is sitting there because it's waiting for this municipality A or province to come. And say, no, we want to, this is what we want to do. Shouldn't perhaps be finding a new approach altogether? It's a very important money. I mean, already, National Treasury, I think with public works or with COPTA, for instance, you have already with MIG said that, well, clearly we can't have a one-size-fits-all of MIG, because you're recognizing these disabilities or whatever you want to call them. But on this one, the uptake of this one, how do we ensure that this money is expended? And I think that it can create the whole kind of what we call it, more jobs. We want to ensure that we create jobs for ordinary people. But the money is sitting there, not delivered. How do we deal with that situation? Thank you. That's round one. Oh, Mam Tim. We okay, come.
No, thank you, Chair. I'm sorry, Chair. I know that you want to give me an opportunity, but then I had an afterthought. Chair, I wanted to check on this grant of school nutrition, because last year I remember that it was spoken at length that there are challenges at the level of the schools, more especially in KwaZulu-Natal, which was quoted, and also Western Cape, on the delays that come in terms of the funds to roll out at school level, which therefore creates a space for the learners to be able to be benefiting out of this grant. So I want to check if there are any measures to address this, so that the learners do not become, they do achieve out of this. Because my observation at the beginning of this year, 2010, as public representatives, when we were going around at the opening of schools, again, we also witnessed such a challenge. I will quote in KZN, where schools are being promised some last year, all procedures and processes were in place, but in terms of finances, they are told to wait whilst they prepare themselves and learners are prepared to be fed at schools. And I think it is indeed affecting those schools that were told, for example, the high schools, because high schools were addressed in quintile 1 and 2 from 2009, but they're not benefiting even up to now. And I think I just wanted to check how far. Yeah.
Chair, just too small on the. This doesn't have a page, but chapter 7 on the recommendation from the FFC. There is a something that says there that there must be a behavioral change program that's linked to infrastructure development. I just want to understand. What is that? What is it meant by that? Mm-hmm. And the last one is on the example you made.
What it means, Honourable Simon, that the centurion coming from the airport,
you need a driver of the same time. I want to hear that. And then the last one is what is in the head of the drafter of the behavioral change. The last one here is on the example made on the decision and implication of budget. Example has been made of three provinces that suggested that while there's pressure on X, the budgeting process direct this way. I just want to understand that whether is it your view that the issue about the priorities that has been decided, there is no consistency with regard to the national and provincial priorities insofar as what the money should buy, the budget should buy. And if you say so, isn't it that in terms of the budgeting process, it should be managed in a different way? Basically that the priorities of government is priorities of government, and that's consistency in it. I just want to understand your examples.
How long will that take with round one, Honorable Chair? I'll actually deflect some of the difficult questions to Andy as I move along. On the local government equitable share, basically the point that you've raised around the districts and basically its role, we even take it further. Beyond the equitable share itself, there are some districts that have got powers and functions, but have got quite a large number of resources. And they get them through, the conditional grant that was put in place for the replacement of the fuel levy, if you can remember, because that was one of the reasons why we've abolished the thing. Now, what we expect, basically, as part of the review, is that the Department of Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs actually spells out what the future of districts is going to be and what the roles of the districts are going to be. Because once you sort that part out, then you can align the fiscal system basically to respond to that. But we are busy with that specific review, and Wendy will talk about it. And on the accreditation of municipalities, the target that's been set is for 2040, that all 27 should be accredited. Our interaction with the National Department of Human Settlements is that they will start with the 6 metros, and gradually, with the experience that they get, phase it over a period of time to the rest of the municipalities. Honourable Ramatlagani, the rural development infrastructure, the 1.2 billion.
As human settlement does that, it will only be the responsibility of human settlement and the provincial department, so National Treasury or provincial treasury will not be involved in the matter.
Okay. Can I park it so that when I answered, when I clarified the question that the Honourable Mashiko raised around how accreditation will work, then I can clarify that, with your permission. I'm from Alex, so in the township there, you know, you just go to the toilet, you flush, and the stuff is there. But in some of the areas, like your more kind of rural areas, the issue around piping, if you want, for example, waterborne sanitation, number one, if you want to pipe it, it may not necessarily happen because it's going to be expensive actually to even do it. Some of the topography in some of the places is of such a nature that kind of piping will not, for example, be allowed for them. That's the one element of it. The other element of it, there's areas that where there's drought, where, you know, even if you're going to put in the piping, the chances are that when you open the tap, there may not necessarily be water. So what we're saying is look at different solutions to be able to address that. One of the solutions, for example, that we're thinking of on the water side has got to do with, for example, water harvesting. Part of this would be to assist households specifically to get those water tanks, for that matter, that they can water harvest and use part of the water, of the rainwater, basically, to be able to help them in providing what their water needs, basically. That, as far as sanitation is concerned, is to looking at specific solutions outside of waterborne sanitation that will be able to assist households specifically to deal with that part. Maybe I should just get to the other points that you've raised. Wendy will talk about the behavioral change, because there is a bit of a relationship basically to that. But on the issue around the concurrent function, and I'll touch on Honorable Sugoni's point that he also basically made there. We have a clear budget process. At the risk of sounding very repetitive, let me possibly just say it. You know, you had, for example, Polokwane for the ANC, right? And out of that, what you had was the manifesto. Out of the manifesto, what you then had was the medium-term strategic kind of, before that even, it filtered into the first State of the Nation address by President Zuma. Out of that, you had a medium-term strategic kind of framework. From there, you then had the outcomes kind of approach. Now, within this entire process, once it gets to us, government, when it gets to the State of the Nation and moving forward, we align this to the budget process. So much so that we've got a process within national that try and incorporate provinces and local government within a specific process. Let me give you an example. We've got what is known, for example, at an official level as a 10x10. Now, in the 10x10, say for education, what you will have is you're going to have the 9 HODs of education from the provinces with a national head of the department. At the same time, what you will have, you'll have the HOD for Treasury as well as the 9 HODs, the Lesetha and the 9 HODs for Treasury. They will sit, they'll tease out now. This is what's going to happen in education, given the signals that were sent by the politicians through their processes. And out of that, we prioritize A, B, C, D out of this. So agreement gets reached basically at that level. And so you do it for health and a number of the other key kind of sectors. And out of that, basically, it feeds into the Minister's Committee on the Budget, where Minister Gordon with his colleagues at the national level sit, deliberate and say, we will introduce this one, propose that we introduce this one now, the other two. And so the process basically go. Then you've got what is known as a budget council, where you've got the 9 MECs for finance and the Minister of Finance actually sitting and say, now that the Minister's Committee on the Budget has done its work, now that the officials at the 10x10 have done their work, what does this mean now for your province? Then we translate that basically into priorities for education, health, and that, and into rands and cents as well, basically, for that. The breakdown comes when the executive must now take the decision. Where do we now put this money? Then at an executive level, what you then will have is the Premier will have another view of the world and decide to say, I understand that there are these priorities, but I think I need another 400-500 million to do A, B, C, D. And in many cases, that 400-500 million is not in congruence with the process right up to that specific kind of point. And that is where you have your kind of disjuncture. Right? Now, we are bound by the Constitution because we can't dictate when it comes to the equitable share and say, thou shalt do the following thing, basically. That is what it comes down to, basically, for that matter. Now, what needs to happen, basically, is a pact, in a way, between the Premier and the President, for that matter, so that they fully understand this. Now, I don't want to enter into the specific politics around it, because if you think about it, the President and the 8 Premiers are from the same party, for example. So there shouldn't be incongruence when it comes to it, because we should be clearly, and they should be understanding each other quite clearly, basically, on the thing. Now, the question is, why do we still, despite the elaborate process that you have, because in addition to the process that I've articulated to you, you've got what is known as extended cabinet, where the premiers are actually invited, and these priorities are basically discussed there. And then the premiers actually, as part of extended cabinet, endorses this framework. So the point is, what happens quite a bit that we, for example, it becomes out of our control to be able to dictate the thing. And the question that we ask is to say, is there a role for legislatures to play in this regard? Because just as you are evaluating the division of revenue bonds, surely a provincial legislature should now also sit with whoever represents the executive there to say, now this is how we understand the priorities. But what we see in your budget doesn't talk to these priorities. And it is at that level that legislature should be able to influence that specific kind of process there. Now, we are reviewing the provincial equitable share formula to actually concretize it at the sector specific kind of level. But even that will not really necessarily solve the problem, because once the money gets lumped, it in any case gets into the province, and the province must decide how it will actually allocate. So the process takes it up to a point, but then once it leaves, say, the national kind of sphere and another process comes in, then that's where you have a problem. Now, in the past, I think 8-9 years, we've fairly succeeded to get the alignment actually going, but still, in a number of provinces, you still had that kind of misalignment. Now, if a province decides to take, say, Mpumalanga, 400 million or 500 million out of the system to do other things, on the margin for education and health, it means quite a lot at the end of the day. So it is how can we get the system to be able to address those anomalies that are actually within the system there. On You've asked this question on behavioral change. It will help for the FFC to also, because it was in the head of the FFC that came up. But they will respond to it at some point. But there is an explanation that Wendy will give basically for that. Honorable, okay. I mean, on the accreditation of municipalities, the function currently is a concurrent function between national and provincial government. In terms of the Housing Act of 97, a province can actually transfer the function or assign the function to a municipality. All right? Now, to assign that function, the terminology accreditation is used. Then you've got three levels of accreditation. The first two levels have got to do with generally getting to program management, to say, but not assigning fully the function. All right? Now, what needs to happen, Honorable Mashego, is the money needs to get to the municipality. Let's say the city of Cape Town is accredited. The money must get from Minister Sekgwale right into the mayor of Cape Town's coffers, basically, when that municipality is fully accredited. Then the province will not be involved at all in that relationship. Now, currently, what is happening here is you've got level 1 and 2 accreditation. And in terms of that accreditation, the province still has got a significant role to play. So what is going to happen is the funds will shift from the National Department of Human Settlements. It will move to the Provincial Department of Human Settlements in the Western Cape. Then the Provincial Department of Human Settlements will then transfer the funds basically to the municipality that is accredited. Now what the clauses want to achieve is to regularize or coordinate that specific relationship. There. So the first thing that we are saying needs to happen is the allocation for the city of Cape Town, for example, needs to be known for the 3 years, all right? So that part needs to happen, and we say it needs to happen before the 30th of April, all right? So that the city of Cape Town can kickstart its processes of delivering the housing function on behalf of the province there. So the clause. One of the clauses fix that part. Then the other clauses are saying if the city of Cape Town, for some reason or the other, does not deliver in line with the agreement that's entered into between the MEC, the national minister, as well as the mayor, what needs to happen, basically. So there's the issue around withholding, stopping, and reallocation, basically. That we're just aligning basically there, so that you don't have a willy-nilly stopping and reallocation of funds, so that we just manage that specific process in a more orderly kind of fashion. Honorable Sogon, you were asking where is the National Treasury in all of this? And I think this matter, if my memory serves me well, it was raised in the Budget Council as well when we've discussed this matter. We are now actively involved in this. The chief directorate that's responsible for local government infrastructure is also now part of the team, because they are also running the Mixed Cities part. So they are also part of the team within the Department of Human Settlements, visiting some of the key municipalities, interacting with them, assessing some of the capacity, basically out of there. So, all the step of the way, we are now part of this specific process. On the lapsing of conditional grants, the electricity and water infrastructure conditional grants to deal with the backlogs that were there. I mean, those were introduced based on what was known at the time, right? And based on what was known at the time, that objective has been basically achieved. Now, Honorable Mashallah, what needs to happen at the provincial level? When a province builds a school, in building that specific school, it needs to take into account all of the infrastructure needs as it relates to that specific school. What we continue to pick up is some of these schools will be built without the requisite kind of infrastructure, as you allude them to be. Right? Now, it's difficult for National Treasury, where it sits, to be able to have that kind of oversight responsibility over that. I think it is fair to expect that the legislature at the provincial level must be able to also monitor and make sure that whatever is rolled out in terms of that indeed actually happens, because as we all are aware, each of those departments, they present their votes within the legislature, they table strategic plans within that legislature, and they also table their annual reports, and within the annual reports, that is where performance is basically assessed. So that the matter of service delivery not happening at the pace at which it needs to be addressed, because if it's not addressed, it results in the backlog that you continue to see over time. So I think it is the area where we need to basically deal with that quite decisively. You've asked the question on roads maintenance. And you allude to the potholes and all of this.
Mm-hmm.
All of this. Now, South Africa has got a huge, I think, roads network. I mean, it's like really kind of phenomenal, the size of the network. Now, the problem that you have is, and I must be careful how I phrase it, does the country have the resources to maintain the network that it currently owns? Must be the first question, right? Which is a key question, right? Now, if you find an answer for that question, and then you look at the demand for health, the demand for education, the demands that are put there for social development and human settlement, you start to make specific kind of trade-offs. Yeah, right? So part of this would be you will continue to have money for road infrastructure, but it is important for human development that you invest in the following four or five kind of key kind of priorities, basically that. But what needs to happen is there's too much leakage in the system. And I think I've raised this a number of times. In some provinces, it cost us 5 million rand to just fix a kilometer of road. Then you go in that same province, exactly the same road, different conditions, it costs you 10 million rand to fix the same kilometer of road. So there are these contract management issues that we are raising now with some of the departments to be able to address the entire road network kind of system quite effectively and efficiently. We have engaged SANRAL as well, because SANRAL has got the capability, for that matter, to be able to give you an indication of the entire road network, which is their road network as well as the provincial road network, and do a condition analysis of each of those specific roads up to a point where it can even tell you which road to invest when for that kind of matter. So that information is basically there. But whether we get the province to be able to prioritize according to that is a bit of a difficulty that we are basically looking into. On the road infrastructure side, just to give you an indication, I think government, and I must just check the number, is spending about 20 billion rand annually on its entire provincial government, on its entire provincial road kind of network. And I am of the opinion that if we can tighten some of the contract management with that same 20 billion, we could be in a position to increase our output by another 20 or 30% without adding any kind of money. So we need to fix basically that part. In addition to that, what provinces need to do, provinces need to establish their own corridors and prioritize specific kind of corridors, because some of the rehabilitation that we see in provinces, you look at the traffic volumes within that same kind of network system, then you realize that the money that was spent to rehabilitate or even to put in a new road vis-a-vis the traffic volumes for that road network, there's no alignment between the two. So at the end of the day, you may have invested money on the wrong road. So possibly if you prioritize, you could actually gain quite a bit of the thing. Now, we have engaged the Department of Cooperative Governance and Institutional Affairs, basically on the issue around capacity, because they're talking about a local government turnaround kind of strategy. And part of the discussion is how do we reorganize the existing kind of streams that are there to actually start to talk to the local government turnaround kind of strategy. Now, we need to take into account that there are budget reforms currently underway at the municipal level. So as part of the National Treasury's responsibility is to ensure that these reforms are actually entrenched within the system of local government in their finances, basically. But what we're starting to talk about now is to say, shouldn't we divide our local government capacity building into three areas? The first area has got to do with the point that you raise around the finance side, you know. The second area has got to do with infrastructure, because infrastructure in itself, the entire local government system exists on infrastructure. So you need to have a specific intervention that focuses primarily on how you build the capacity for infrastructure. The third strand, which is a very important kind of strand, has got to do with governance and administration. Because if you don't fix your governance and administration problems that you have, the relationship between ward committees, your mayors, your councillors, the mayoral committees, there will forever be havoc between that as well as the rest of whatever you want to achieve within that specific kind of municipality. You know, there's this municipality in Mpumalanga that I like a lot, Steve Tshwete municipality. Not because I schooled there in Middelburg, but just something that we've seen in the municipality. Firstly, the entire top structure of that municipality virtually remained the same for the past 8 to 10 years. And the entire structure of councillors and even the mayor, actually remained constantly over that specific period. And a good working relationship between the executive kind of your council part as well as the bureaucracy at the end. And I think that is one of the most well-run municipalities in the province, if not in the country. I think they're even well-run than the city of Cape Town and a number of the municipalities. Those are the lessons that we say, what is it that they are doing right that we can copy and actually transpose onto the rest of the specific municipalities. But this, the three strands that I'm talking about is how we want to see this actually unfolding. So we hope our minister and the Minister of Cooperative Governance will find each other on this, so that by the end of March, when we engage the DVSA, we can then have some kind of a memorandum of understanding on how this thing will actually kind of work, basically. What we're also looking into is to capacitate provincial treasuries to do proper oversight over municipal finances. Because in Gauteng and to a great extent Western Cape, and we see now that KwaZulu-Natal is also building their capacity within the treasury, we get a better response time on detecting a problem and actually solving it. So we're also looking at that specific model as a way of intervening there. Now, and this is very important, our current capacity building programs at a local level have distorted the labor market. All that our CNZ managers and all of these programs did, they took the CFOs that were working in those municipalities at their salaries and converted them into consultants. So those positions, for that matter, just remain vacant, because that same guy
is going back to the municipality at three times the salary to do that kind of job. So we need, we're looking at how do we solve that distortion as well. On EPWP and its impact, I think there were two of those questions that were asked. Honorable Sogoni, you also asked that specific question. I think on page 45 of the budget review, there should be some kind of an answer to this. The last paragraph, it gives an indication that an assessment has been done. Between 2004 and 2009, 1.6 million short-term jobs have been created. 955 in on the infrastructure side, 468 you're working for water kind of in, on the environmental side, and then 174 on the social sector side. So that has happened, but I think we also need to accept, I think, that EPWP will not solve the country's employment problem. It is just a temporary measure that says, once we have this, how do we just intervene on a temporary basis to be able to alleviate the problem that is basically there? That will not solve the country's problem, basically. But I think the country can work smarter to be able to deal with unemployment, specifically government in the way they operate, by the way. Currently, provinces are spending on average 40 billion rand annually on infrastructure programs. It will be interesting to see whether those programs have translated in SMME development, whether they have translated in the kind of permanent job creation and kind of industrialism that you would want to see at the micro kind of level. I'm a former school principal, so I like the schooling system. And, oh, there's a lot of them. I mean, the easiest way to create jobs, if you take a school, for example, travel the length and breadth of this country. When you go to all our non-formal model C schools, the grass is this tall, the windows are broken, the roofs are dilapidated, and you don't need a specific skill to be able to fix those things, you see. So you could, because in some of the communities, the schools are actually clustered. You'll have two or three high schools with six, seven primary schools. Why can't we get entrepreneurship, for example, going by encouraging people to become garden services for themselves within the community? You find a way of just getting somebody to buy a few tractors, not tractors, but these lawn mowers and weed eaters to cut. Once that spirit comes in, that person can, for that matter, go to Nketekete next door and start to say, I see your grass in your yard is tall, can't I cut it for 20 rand very quickly? Yes. And then the spirit within the community of entrepreneurship can actually just kick in quite early. What we're also looking into, and this is going to be a longer term kind of matter, it's still under discussion, at an education level, for example, as issues around physical education, which is the PT, this thing that we did when we were training. Because currently that is non-existent even in not your former Model C school, the rest of our schools. You don't have physical education kind of trainers. Is to see whether we can't take some of our matriculants who just passed, who are very good, by the way, athletes, and get them to, say, some kind of a crash course and get them employed at relatively lower salary, but decent salaries, for that matter, at the permanent level, to get them onto the system to become physical education trainers within the school kind of system. It's an option that's there. Once you get them there, they may like to be in the education system, and then you can get them to become fully fledged teachers over a period of time. So there are these other things that I think we possibly need to look into and solve it. But another important one that relates to this infrastructure has got to do with the issue of value for money. I mean, the scary stuff that we've seen. In fact, and this is why our minister is very big on this issue around corruption and how we deal with contract management. In some provinces, a school in Gauteng, let me mention it, where you come from, sir. A school that is that should be built for 24 million is being built for 70 million.
70.
I can give you the details. For 70 million. Now think about it this way. You could have built three schools and created, yes, and created so many other jobs around it. So how we manage our contracts is quite an integral part in dealing with this. Honorable Chana, I don't know whether in answering Mr. Ramatlakane's question, I was partly answering your question on provincial treasury's role in concurrent functions. The treasuries will present what the budget council has taken as being the one to the exco's. But ultimately, it's the exco's that take some of the decisions that we see that are misaligned, basically. That. So it's how we need to solve that part. I mean, I'll check on the point that you've raised on the FFC stuff around, I think it's the maintenance and the social housing, just to check the wording, but I'll check it in how we've responded in the budget review and take it up, would you? On the issue around dams, in fact, I had an engagement with the Department of Water Affairs, basically, on this. Firstly, before you get to the dams, we need to solve our reticulation problem that's there. You still have your Dewop Dam in Limpopo that's there, but next to it people don't have water because there's no system that takes the water basically from that dam to the people. So how we deal with the bout and the reticulation part, we need to possibly resolve. But I think you are right. This is the area where government actually needs to take a conscious decision that says, how are we going to solve our water problems? Yeah, right. And one hopes through the Department of through the Ministry of Planning that the issue around, because I think it is on the radar screen for them as well, the issue around water resources, the issue around electricity, all of that would form part of the mandate actually of the Department of Planning. Ne? Where are you going to? Ne? Yeah. Yeah. Then you've asked the question on savings at the provincial level. I must say we have quite succeeded. What we have done, just to give you an indication, what we have done where we will cost something, let's say the salary bill, provinces need to get an additional 5, 6, or 7 billion. To deal with, say, improvements of conditions of service. Instead of giving them 5, 6, and 7, we would give them 4, 5, and 6. And then say, go and find the difference within your budget. That was one thing that we've done. The second thing that we've raised specific issues that relate to, for example, your conferencing, your travel, etc., that we've raised. We went actually into our BAS system, our basic accounting system. And within each province, we can see there how much they travel, how much money they spend on catering, how much on travel, etc. Then we've generated tables that we've circulated to the provinces. And we said, use this as a basic guide to be able to cut expenditure. In the case of Mpumalanga, for example, they went into each of the departments, for that matter, and identified the amounts. And then they said, we will take these amounts out. And then we will put it back into maybe education, etc. So they have done quite that. A province like the Western Cape, they're also doing it, but they have been doing it for some time. So the gains for them would be on the margin for that matter. Whereas in a province like Gauteng, the gains are huge. I mean, it would be scary if I can tell you what we've achieved with Gauteng now. You know, if you can remember Gauteng, they also took part in the Formula One, where they put money set aside for large amounts of money, for that matter. So there is that element that we're sorting out so that we identify those ones and the money must go back to that. But the next area of saving is the issue around contract management that I've raised on the school side. But also, if you go into health, something like the health information system, for example, where you've got 9 provinces, everybody wants to procure their own health information system and all of that. So one needs to start to say, no, but maybe you shouldn't do it that way. Maybe we need to find national government to get an entire health information system that will talk to each other and find a way of procuring it, and out of that possibly that you could generate specific kind of savings. So within the budgets, we are doing quite a bit of detailed work to be able to look at kind of specific kind of savings. But I think we still have a long way to go with that. Wendy, I don't know whether you want to talk about, then I'll talk to the rest of the other questions.
Okay, maybe just to add to what Kenneth said, because he's added this, mostly answered most of the questions already. So maybe just to add, with regard to the FFC proposals, it's discussed in more detail in the bill, because I went through it quite fast with some of my responses. If you look, for example, on the rental housing, it's dealt with in more detail on pages 63 and 64, where it specifically indicates why it's a different program. It says the restructuring of rental housing aims to facilitate the further provision of rental accommodation by the private sector in areas where no or minimal investment in rental housing is occurring but is required. And if you look then at the third one about the income bands, that answer is also provided. Again, it's a similar type of answer, again, because it's targeted at a specific benefit group and exactly how it's dealt with. Sorry for going through it a bit too fast. I wanted to save a bit of time. So if you're looking for the detailed responses, it is contained in the documents. Another important issue that was raised is about the differentiation, specifically as it relates to the EPWP program. Again, if you can go to the conditional grant framework in this document, I'll give you the page number. It is page 148. It deals with the eligibility criteria. There is a slight bit of differentiation introduced where it's specifically stated with regard to rural municipalities, they have to have a zero minimum threshold to qualify in 2010-11 to make it easier for them to get into the system. But it does not take away from the other questions that's been asked, is this the right way to actually deal with this program? And I think that's a good question that can be asked tomorrow, I think, when Department of Public Works are here to talk about what they've done and also what they've achieved with that type of program. But also building on Kenneth's point that this is a partial solution to a much bigger problem in that regard. With regard to the DMA question, the equitable share will continue, even with in addition to the point that Kenneth has made, is because the equitable share goes to the municipalities that authorise to provide a service. And that authorisation is contained in the Municipal Structures Act, which indicates what district is responsible for water and sanitation and what local municipalities are responsible. For example, in the Western Cape, all the local municipalities are authorised. So yes, if the DMA comes along or gets incorporated, a component, and that's the basic services component, they will get zero. But there's still the institutional components and the equitable share formula as well. But this answer will be different for municipalities, for example, in Limpopo, where the district municipality is authorised, where they still get the water and sanitation. So it's an issue that we need to look at it actually gets a better fit, because what you currently get the district municipalities with very little service responsibilities are getting huge amount of money, which is going to luxuries, where you actually get district municipalities in the poorer areas of the country, which is getting very small allocations, and they need to make the best. And then you've still got this unclear division, legally it's clear, but practically it's not that clear who's responsible for what water and sanitation functions between Category B and C municipalities. So there's a lot of policy reforms that need to be undertaken and clarified, because the funding actually needs to follow the function. And if the function is not clear, it's actually a huge problem. With regard to the behavioral change, the issue is if you actually put in place infrastructure, for example, and you haven't been educated or not to correctly use it, you can actually mess up the system by putting the wrong things into the system. I mean, if you go to, for example, toilets, it's often said you must not put this and this in the toilet because you'll clog up the system. That is the type of education. When it comes to, for example, ventilated to improve fit routines as well, it's how to do the maintenance of the system. It's got to do with, for example, what do you do with regard to rivers, or what do you do not with regard to the rivers to actually keep clean. So those are the type of sanitation intervention and education that's important. It's for people to do the right thing and behave correctly to ensure a safe environment.
All of the questions, except I don't think I've satisfied the honorable member on the school nutrition one. I have to acknowledge.
Nabo.
Well done.
Wendy to rather explain it in her own very flowery, flowery English.
Or you want Janine to earn her ticket?
No, not Janine. Wendy. No, Honorable Mashiach, on Sunrail, I mean, there's a road reclassification system. So Sunrail can't work in the roads which are not national. So, in fact, what needs to happen is the key kind of routes needs actually to be identified and be reclassified as national and then actually be solved in that way. Where Sunrail can assist, and this is where Nazir Ali has said, he says they can actually assist the province in identifying the road network where they need to invest in as a matter of urgency. They can even go as far as helping them with the procurement processes of those, right? So over and above that, we are also looking at some kind of a maintenance strategy to be able to deal with that. Because if you don't increase your maintenance budget, your road problem will just be there and it will just multiply over a period of time. So we are looking at that and finding a way of supporting provinces basically to deal with it. Wendy will talk to you about the school infrastructure stuff that relates to water and sanitation. Wendy, come on.
Thanks for that. Kenneth dealt with even going forward, we're still experiencing problems where provinces are not really doing what they're supposed to be doing with regard to schools, where they put in place water and sanitation and electricity, which should be part of the overall budget. That grant was put in place specifically to deal with historical backlogs where it did not happen. And this was a transitional grant meant to deal with those type of problems. And in terms of, I'm just trying to get last year's conditional grant where they actually give feedback. The problems that was identified at that stage when the grants were put in place were largely addressed. And therefore, it was also when a grant is considered, it is actually given a specific lifespan, and that lifespan has also been concluded. So that was part of the process, and it's actually something that I would propose in the future that the committee also look at. Because if you look at the conditional grant framework, it actually gives a specific time frame, and some of the grants are specifically circulated with a specific date. And if the criteria is largely met by these two, the grant has been disestablished. But it doesn't mean that there's not grant funding for that purpose as well. There's still the electrification fund as well as the MIG fund that can still be used for that type of expenditure as well. So it is actually, to some extent, a duplication of what's already been in the system. It is, if you look at the conditional grant framework, it's actually an important thing that the government team needs to look at and also give recommendations going forward.
Maybe just to add, I think what Honorable Mashego is raising is a red herring. To say you started the program, it appears the program has been successful. But I think the program didn't really address the full scope of backlogs that may still be necessarily there, and that we need to possibly relook at it so that we address those specific kinds of ones. So it's something, Wendy, that we will keep at the back of our mind so that when we engage the department in a new round for the next budget, that we possibly resuscitate that specific grant and say, there are still, because what we've picked up even with the bucket eradication system, if you can recall, Honorable Sagone, is that when we started with the program, we actually reached out quite a bit of communities. But later on, when we wanted to discontinue it, people were saying, no, you haven't reached us yet, so continue with it. And I think this is what Honorable Mesh was saying. We may want to just continue with it for some time until we've addressed quite a bit of that. We will keep it at the back of our mind and address it accordingly.
Because now you mentioned the Gau train and the Honorable Singh is here. I know that at one time they were contesting for the Natal train. So I don't think that we should continue any further from here. On a serious note, Mr. Singh didn't hear anything. He's got a small question.
Chairperson,
we really want to conclude now.
No, Chairperson, it has nothing to do with trains or anything else. I'm sorry I'm late. I was at SCOPA. But the interesting thing, Chairperson, is at SCOPA just now, we were dealing specifically with the annual report and the Division of Revenue Act. And I'm just pulling the document out there. And the conditional grant framework that was referred to is referred to here, 14th April 2008. But my concern, and we have this over the Department of Health, I mean, it's public knowledge, that 14 billion rand was transferred to provinces as conditional grants. But according to the report of the Auditor General, and I'm sure it applies to many other departments, there is no quarterly monitoring, there is nothing that happens to ensure that those monies are being spent for what it was actually allocated to them. And when we asked the Office of the Auditor General, they said it is a general concern that in most of the departments this doesn't happen. So if the mother department, like here the Department of Health, doesn't monitor, doesn't do what they are supposed to do, what do you think is happening down at the grassroots level with those funding? The second thing is the interest. There's flood disaster management money that's been transferred by the hundreds of millions to municipalities and to everybody else for particular projects. But municipalities don't use that money for those projects which they applied for. And then what happens with the interest that accrues from the funds that are given to them as a once-off for projects which sometimes take 2 years to complete? So I thought I'll just raise that, because it's good to give them the money, but are they actually using it properly? And the Auditor General's report shows that this particular department is not.
thing.
Well, you can't say when a leader wants to raise a question, say don't raise anything. You're not part of that. But earlier, before you arrived, I think it was Mr. Brown himself who raised the issue of the center. Issue of priorities between national and provincial, that's one, but two, the issue of monitoring. I think it's a question that we should throw back to us as members. We should be doing this monitoring. Is it not after that? Is it public representative? For me, I think that we all have a role. And I think the role that we have sometimes we really undermine the role that we have of doing oversight, and sometimes relegating it to certain people to do this oversight. We appropriate this money, then we walk away after appropriating. We'll come back next year and do that. Or wait for the Auditor General, for instance. I'm not sure, you were not here, Mr. Brown, last week. We were raising the question. And I think that FFC, oh, you were here. Because we raised continuously at this point, raised this question of monitor, you know. What is the thing going to, it was last week when we were saying, look, we only wait for the Auditor General to give us a report. Each and every department has a portfolio committee that is in charge for this report. And there is us on the other side. I think it was last week when we were saying, maybe we should also look at PFMA. You are not here. We should look at PFMA and say, number one, the issue that we are referring there at the time is that PFMA conference talks about the monthly report. It does not talk to quarterly report. But we're looking at this report quarterly, not monthly. It doesn't talk about that. But what we were saying is that we need to go just beyond looking at figures, but say, what is this money being spent on? The value of that. Now, what we wait for instance, wait for Sunday Times or Auditor General to pick out that this amount of money was spent for this. So I think that the indictment is upon us as Parliament to say, are we really doing what is expected of us to really be monitoring the expense, the expenditure on this money? I don't think that we're there yet. I don't think that we're there yet. And I think that the experience, for instance, that SCOPA has can share with other people. How do we ensure that we monitor? If you look at the last week, we got a presentation on Friday, né? For the quarterly report. Né? And we're going to have hearings on the quarterly report. When we invite our colleagues to come and be part of that, because they don't read quarterly reports, they're not going to come and listen to that. Now, how do we do what Honorable Singh, for instance, is talking about? Ensuring that as a health portfolio committee, we know what happened to the money that was appropriated to the provinces. The chairperson of NCOP is sitting here. They're going to get quarterly reports of the provincial quarterly reports, every quarter, very detailed reports. To what extent are we making use, for instance, of those reports? That's why I'm saying maybe the question we can put to National Treasurer. National Treasurer will say to us, here is information for you to make use of us. Not upon us as members to say, what do we do about this information? We get money from constituency work to do constituency work. All these kind of tools are at our disposal. So are we making what we call a use of those tools as members, all of us, honorable, across what we call across parties, for example.
sometimes we just turn a blind eye, we walk away. And maybe sooner or later our constituencies are going to raise these things. Now all of us are paying attention to local government because there are protests at the local government level. But there's more work for us. We're really not doing enough. Maybe ours oversight is an evolving, what you call the kind of oversight. We have achieved a number of things, but clearly it means that there's a lot that still needs to be done to ensure that. I think the question of oversight, I find it very exciting, but we're not doing enough. Colleagues know that we raise it over and over. The question, for instance, if I were to summarize, just to move towards concluding, there's a clause here in the division of revenue. Is it clause what, 26? I'm not sure. Which talks about planning. The question that Honorable Brown we raised with the national departments, for instance, that sometimes understand. We asked them, is MTF, this system of budgeting, is it working? We're raising it because of frustration. Because we find a situation where departments come to us, they've not been able to do this. Now, we got a report from the said quarterly report. I can tell you the department that has spent around 62% and what, 50-something%. Come end of the fourth quarter, people will have spent 100%. Or over 101%. So clearly, it's looking for oversight to say if you're at 62%, 54% at the end of December, how come that now you have 100% in 3 months' time? 46% you have spent in 3 months. You could not spend it over 9 months. Come end of the first quarter, people will be struggling to spend. Why? No, the tenders, the delay in this and that and that. That's why, for me, we get frustrated and say, but does the MTF really assist us? It is there supposed to assist us. And the Division of Revenue puts it very clear that people must, by the 30th of August, indicate what kind of infrastructure are they going to do and municipalities by October. I don't know if it happens. I don't know why they are not able to. No, I mean, I like comparing the fourth quarter and the first quarter. And I think that if people really spending as the fourth quarter is high, you are expecting that there should be a continuation of that into the first quarter. It does not happen. So clearly, there's something wrong with the fourth quarter. I mean, it's obvious. So, another thing I'm saying, this night should cut both sides. Ask ourselves, the PFMA, for instance, gives both treasuries, provincial and national treasuries, responsibility to do monitoring. I'm not sure whether to what extent is that kind of work being done. But us also the responsibility of doing oversight, I mean the constitutional responsibility of doing that. To what extent are we doing it? The question, for instance, maybe we must still look at the annual report of the public works to say how much was budgeted for this incentive last year. Of that amount, how much was taken up by the provinces and municipalities? But we do know that very little that was taken up by that. And what is it that can be done to ensure that public works is assisted to deliver on that incentive? You see, this incentive this year, 680 million rand, next year goes to over a billion. over M and over MTF. It's a lot of money. But how do we ensure that it reaches those communities that it's intended for? So we think that colleagues, the National Treasury, I think that was just giving up the taste of what is to come over the week or over when we're doing a appropriation, for instance. The questions that we raise, I think we'll have to raise directly with those departments. National Treasury attempted to answer the question, but those departments, they must tell us what is it that they intend doing. And I would want to ask members maybe to go through this EME. It's not very small. It's a bit scary, you know. But have to get to look at the strategic plans of especially those departments that we're going to be dealing with very closely. So that when we look at their planning and what they have expanded on, do these things correspond, for instance, do they pass in those kind of things? But on that note, you are inviting us to. Well, I'm informed that we can go to lunch now. There's no lunch that is organized, and we meet at 2 o'clock.